Bill has pointed out a lot of things about, say, the reservoirs going down. I want to bring this up and toss this out for just a little bit of thought. One of the things that Bill points out is that CO2 in the atmosphere is contributing largely to the global warming that's happening as we speak. Now, when he was talking about what's happening at Lake Mead and also up at Lake Powell, or his brother Abby used to call it Lake Fowl, as that water goes down, ultimately it will go down far enough that it won't be able to make the hydroelectric power necessary to generate the electricity that we think we need throughout the American West. And so you can bet that there will be a lot of people saying, well, there's a lot of coal out here, and so maybe we should start mining the coal and building more power plants like the Four Corners power plant, the San Juan power plant, the Navajo generating station. So I'd like to toss that one out. Does anybody have any ideas about other forms of generating electricity in the American Southwest? In other words, what are some of the things that we can do to allay some of this stuff?
End the capitalist system. Stop growth for the sake of growth. Find a philosopher like Adam Smith or Karl Marx that can come up with a panoramic, with a macroscopic overview of what climax capital and capitalism is doing to the planet and has done to the planet, and figure out another way of going about it in which we can begin diminishing growth and stopping the growth of an economic system which creates the growth of people who demand more growth in the economic system which demand more growth of people, which then demand more utilization of resources, finding more resources, doing more fracking to get more water, to feed more factories, to create more products that will then create more people, yada, 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 ad infinitum. I mean, in that little talk I gave at the Land Institute in Salina, I remember that the one thing that people don't talk about so much is that there was a movie a long time ago called The Solid Gold Trap, just about being a family trying to upscale, you know, in the middle class system in America. But we are in a trap, you know, in an economic system that traps us to buy newer cars, to drive SUVs, to use more petrol. And like Bill says, okay, so we're going to conserve water, but then you get caught because the water we conserve immediately goes to feed another Las Campanas in Santa Fe, a new development, yada, yada, yada. And we are locked into this economic. I brought a little book with me. I brought two little books. One little book is The Closing Circle by Barry Commoner that was published in 1971. Everybody should go out and get a copy and read it. Barry Commoner is an environmentalist who foresaw everything that we're dealing with now in the 70s, like Rachel Carson foresaw it in the 60s, and like Thoreau foresaw it in 1835, and probably like Ben Franklin saw it when he wrote an essay complaining about candlelight in Paris, you know, how everybody was just wasting resources by lighting candles in Paris when he was over there in 1773 or 6 or 8 or 9. But one thing I do like about Barry Commoner is he says, you know, that an economic system based on eternal growth is incompatible with the survival of the planet. So, you know, my feeling is, you know, is that somehow we need to agitate for a complete change in the economic philosophy that drives us.
Can I
that you can't use the master's rule to dismantle the master's house.
I have a cheerful remark to make, which is, first it will be a sad remark, and then it will turn into a cheerful one, that there have been decades in which water utilities, the managers of water utilities never spoke to land use planners, and land use planners never spoke to them. And so in our area, there would be multiple condemnations that Denver Water was encouraging growth or permitting growth or allowing growth. And you can read Denver Water's charter over and over and over and over again, and you can never see the part that says that they have power to decree who lives where, which areas are to be developed, which areas are not. So land use planners for counties and cities do have that power, and this is something that young people, there's a few young people there, I think if your hearts can soar over this, let's give this a try. Isn't it great that land use planners are talking to utility managers now? And that's actually happening, and people are trying to do something besides just blame the water utility for not using powers they don't have. So that seems to me one place where you can see something. I'm not sure the word capitalism comes up as much as some might think it should in that discussion, but people who are very fragmented from each other, who need to be in conversation for those kinds of constraints to happen, those people are chatting with each other, which seems, it's not,
thank you.
Hearts don't soar when I tell you that, but if you hang out in those circles and you see a land use planner and a utility manager talking to each other, you think, there's hope there, so.
Well, I want to, apropos of what you both have been talking about, one of the things I'd like to toss out as a possible entree into solution making here is the possibility of gradual decentralization of political power so that a grassroots movement of political power can begin to grow within the watershed. Eleanor Ostrom, who is somebody I really liked a lot, she and her husband came up with a notion of what they call polycentric governance. And what that means is grassroots at the bottom, the federal hierarchy we have at the top, instead of having just from the top down, we have a huge amount coming from the bottom up, which means all of us here become involved in some level and really try to understand how we as individuals and then we as groups of individuals can create cultures of practice that are commensurate with today's problems. Does this resonate with anybody?
With the
decentralization of
the Tea Party is behind that and supportive of that to break.
Well, I think we need a green Tea Party.
That's a clever line there, but I don't know. I think it's my personal feeling as an historian is that we have had the romance of local control and we have had the romance of centralized control, particularly Theodore Roosevelt, Gifford Pinchot times. We'll give all these decisions to these folks in Washington, they'll make wiser decisions for the people. Both of those are romances, that the notion that virtue and wise decisions will come from decentralization, that's a very powerful romance. The notion that it will come from experts in Washington who were friends of Theodore Roosevelt, that was a powerful notion, but it's the dance back and forth. There are some things that local powers aren't that effective at. There are some places where it becomes madness and disorientation to have so many different local states. And in water is one of them, because
Eleanor brought up the fact that the way it works is when people trust each other.
Well, we're not in a good state. Can I just say on that point, though, the water is very decentralized in its management.
That's what I love about it.
Okay, that's a complicated situation.
Sometimes it is, not always.
We have a bunch of reservoirs where it's very centralized. It's also evaporating off the tops of them. But go ahead, Bill.
Well, I was just thinking, the great political philosopher, you spoke of needing good philosophers. Isaiah Berlin pointed out that from the crooked timber of humanity, nothing straight was ever made, which is a fancy way of saying we just muddle along, you know, and no system is going to give us the panacea. You know, there's not, I agree with John that capitalism going full blast, we're wrecking the planet, it can't last forever. We're gonna have to really experiment a lot one thing is not going to be the answer. Many things are probably going to be the answer. One of the things that attracts me so much to that Powell map of watersheds is the notion that under Powell's system, it wasn't just that watersheds would be self-governing. It would be that there would be so many of them going along that self-determining route. There would be so many experiments going on. Some of them would have been disasters. Some of them might have found innovations that really worked. There would have been just a great deal of learning from all that experimentation. I think to get through the problems that we face with energy, with water, et cetera, we need to have a very, very high level of experimentation going forward.
I concur heartily with that.
John Muir once said, when we try to pick out anything by itself, we find it hitched to everything else in the universe. And I get worried sometimes when I hear, I say, okay, we got 20 different watersheds, right? And each one is going to be worked out according, there's a Navajo watershed here, and then the Pueblo watershed there, and then the Albuquerque, whatever's feeding Albuquerque, whatever's feeding San Luis Valley in Colorado, that, I mean, you run into a huge problem with you can't manage each watershed differently because they're all interconnected to one planet. Right?
That's right. And exactly. Powell, for instance, was one of the earliest advocates of interstate, read interwatershed compacts and agreements.
Yeah.
Because you can't manage just one watershed as though it's unconnected to everything.
No, it's not. I mean,
no, they're all connected.
I mean, you know, the concept of private property often seems to me insane, right? Because my neighbor can go to the local flower shop and get dieldrin or something in a bottle and spray his or her peach trees. But the wind, the breeze, can blow the dieldrin into my yard, right? And hit my grass or something.
Who are you?
What?
Who are you?
Or me, and I could inhale it. You know, yeah. I mean, one of the problems is there's got to be rules that everybody follows, you know? And if you keep having a system where, you know, each state treats its water differently, you know, and each property owner treats their property differently, then you're just interfering endlessly with the fact that everything is interconnected, that the air that I'm breathing in Taos, New Mexico, can have toxins in it like toxaphene sprayed on cotton fields in Louisiana to kill boll weevils, or it can have pesticides sprayed on fields in northern China that then have the spring droughts that blow dust all the way across the Pacific that land in my yard.
What you're saying is, like, right now there is a move in the United States to mine Navajo coal and mine Montana coal and ship it to Washington State, where it can thence be shipped to China to burn in coal-fired power plants to thus reduce the quality of our air here in New Mexico. In other words, we have to look at the bigger picture.
So do you have a problem with that?
A modest one, yes. I don't know what time it is. What time is it?
It's
8:25.
Let's do some rapid questions.
There's a whole slug of
quick answers.
But let's just do quick answers.
I'm sorry?
It's like at the end of Peter Sagal's show where the lightning fill-in-the-blank
I want to bring up one lightning. Here's one. It's right on the top. We can't address all of them, and they're all great. But this is hearkening back to people like Tim DeChristopher and Edward Abbey and Henry David Thoreau. Please name one type or example of civil disobedience that you believe we should engage in to raise New Mexicans' commitment to take this water issue seriously. I like that.
Great. Say it again.
Civil disobedience.
I will read it more slowly. Please name one type or example of civil disobedience that you believe that we should engage in to raise New Mexicans' commitment to take this water issue seriously?
Okay, quick, right? Okay.
Yeah.
Monkey Wrench Gang, SWAT teams that go in and xeriscape a creepy neighbor's yard in the night.
That's a good one, Patty.
I think
but the neighbor wakes up and is grateful. That's all.
Okay, lightning strike.
If you reduce your lifestyle to, say, $30,000 a year, refuse to grow, refuse to keep up with the Joneses, you know, use family planning, don't have more than 1.5 children, don't drive a Cadillac Escalade. I mean, there's a million things you can do just personally to begin changing your personal philosophy and ideology so that then you can begin to expand that ideology in the community you live in.
But it
requires figuring out how to really downsize your own existence.
Actually, you said to me one time many years ago, growing a sunflower is a political act, and I really like that.
I think I said maybe writing about a sunflower.
No, you said growing one.
Well, growing it and then writing about growing it. You could write about growing it. That would.
I've said some
faces.
Really asshole things.
All right, here's another one. Boy, I don't know if any of us on this panel could cope with this one, but I think it's a great one. There is no evolutionary precedent for a species to self-limit. What can we draw on then?
A picture of humanity sodomizing the planet.
Let me say one thing here.
I
want to hearken to one. If everybody's mentioning philosophers, just one second.
Okay.
Everybody's mentioning favorite philosophers. I would like to mention Peter Kropotkin, who happens to be one of my favorite philosophers, where on page 300 of his magnum opus, Mutual Aid, he said, and I'm paraphrasing only slightly, evolution of species, parenthetically, human culture, owes far more to mutual cooperation than mutual antagonism.
Patty,
okay, so the question, I was going to say that I think that capitalism in first world countries coincides with a drop in the birth rate. Education of women in first world societies and so on, and it can happen in other places, so that capitalism, curiously enough, has a population limiting quality in places of prosperity where women get educated. That seems to be the key to population control, is sufficient change and prosperity within a society so that women have more control of what they're doing. And so, in fact, first world countries, it levels out to the point of concern. Some xenophobes are, oh, no, there's not enough of us. So that's an interesting thing, that there is a self-limiting quality that comes with education of women and thriving societies.
I want to respond to Patty, and then I'll get, but in part,
our lightning quality is not quite.
Within a capitalist-oriented society, we may no longer be fructifying out of control. I think I said that in that book. But we are. The relationship of ourselves to what we use within the context of the capitalist world is enormous relative to the many, many families that I visited in third world cultures or fourth world cultures. John.
The capitalist system doesn't just exist in the first world. It's connected to everything else. What we do in the first world by reducing our children and by having a more upscale lifestyle creates the poverty in third world countries where they keep having 8 to 10 children because 4 of them are going to die, and they want 6 of them to survive to work in the soybean fields in Brazil in order to send the soybean products to China. I mean, capitalism, the rich countries, yes, birth control goes down, but capitalism isn't just functioning in the rich countries. Yep. It's functioning in South Sudan, Somalia, Ethiopia, Kenya, Haiti, Bolivia. It's just not connected to us.
To add one happy footnote to this, if you do the math on as capitalism spreads, as life styles improve and standards of living improve around the globe, in order to get to that population break that the demographers talk about, where family size starts going down and population levels off, to get the world to that place would require so much energy and so much resource use, we would cook the planet several times over, if you do the math, which Jim Brown and his team at UNM have been doing. So that hope doesn't seem as good these days as it did 20 years ago.
One of the members of our panel was speaking about the value of experimentation and finding alternatives in other ways. And I find it, I mean, things could happen. There are other ways to reach that state of well-being. So the fatalism and the confidence with which some of you predict the future is weird to me. I mean, I don't have that prophetic gift, and it must be a delight to... I don't know. It's just a puzzle to me how confident you are when you say something gloomy. The science writer Timothy Ferris once, I was on a panel with him, and I said something to his progress, and I said, oh, I guess we're not supposed to speak about progress. And Timothy Ferris said, because I said, oh, we're not supposed to be praising things in those terms. He said, your people, I was at that time a conventional white liberal, your people are happy to talk about decline and to speak of it with certainty and clarity as if you had all the metrics for determining that.
I'm only trying to make the point, Patty, that the population break isn't the panacea necessarily.
Well, there are different ways to get to that, unless you are fatalistic and can see the future.
Yeah, and we haven't found them yet. We need to find them if we're going to get there.
Yes, okay. Yeah.
One thing I'd like to bring up, and John Nichols and my lifetimes, the population of this planet has more than tripled. And that's a big thought in Vern's lifetime.
Well, we've all had the benefit of living in the biggest boom in history after World War II. I mean, I grew up in a society where we had hot water 3 squares a day, and there was just an eternal boom in this country with a few little setbacks right up until the present day, or the 2008 collapse, and we're beginning to see the end of that boom. And the boom has given me a wonderful life. I mean, I always wake up every morning and I say, thank God that I live in America in the 20th and 21st century, where I can take a bath every night.
We're the surfers on the perfect wave.
Yeah, you know. And yet that boom that has created this marvelous society for many of us and screwed an awful lot of the planet in the process has created the disasters that befall us, you know, that we are facing. That, I mean, you know, every time I walk into Smith's in Taos, Taos is a little itty-bitty town. It's not New York City, not Las Vegas, like your chapter on Las Vegas. Mulroy, what's the name
Patricia
of that lady
Mulroy.
In Las
Patricia
Vegas?
Mulroy. Patricia Mulroy.
Drilling under Lake Mead and going crazy or whatever. But I mean, when I walk into Smith's supermarket in Taos and I look at the parking lot, my heart just sinks because there's so many modern cars and SUVs and huge pickup trucks. And this is a town where 40% of the people don't have health care, or 30% don't have health care, and where the standard of living is lower than just about anywhere else in New Mexico, except maybe Rio Arriba and Mora County. And then I walk into the supermarket, and every time I walk into Smith's, there's just layers and layers. There's shelves and shelves and shelves of goodies and Pringles potato chips and taco chips and this and that, one thing and another, beans and Campbell's soups. And for me, it's like walking into Armageddon. It's just this plethora of so-called food is just, it's not just irresponsible, but it's insane. And I recall often being in Nicaragua in 1983 during the Sandinista Revolution, right? And Nicaragua, I think, was the second poorest country in our hemisphere after, with Haiti being on the bottom and maybe Bolivia. And I remember walking into a supermarket in Nicaragua, in Managua, there was nothing on the shelves. We walked in and there was just like, in one little shelf, there were like 10 little cans of beans and the rest of it was empty. You know, and I don't see how we can driving to Albuquerque in the traffic and looking at the modern cars, you know, on the highway. And everybody says, well, President Obama has created new standards for conservation of fuels, right, in cars. And yet Detroit and Japan are building enormous cars. So just what Bill was talking about, you know, we're conserving gas so that we can make 200 million more cars or something like that to use the conserved gas. And it's like having a loved person that you love that smokes 3 packs of cigarettes a day. You know, it's like we are smoking 3 packs of cigarettes a day.
We're about out of time, so I want to, we have some more wonderful questions. We're not going to have time to answer them because I'm being notified from the wings. But I want to say this. I spent my 65th birthday in the presence of Dan Kemmes, who at that time was the mayor of Missoula, Montana.
I slept with him once. We were roommates at the dinner party in May 1991 in Jackson Hole, Wyoming.
Come the revelations.
That's right.
I was not in the bed.
I slept with him once.
Whatever you do, try not to get any on you. But Dan
Kemmes.
He was
the Republican mayor.
Dan Kemmes said to me, one of the big things that we have to get past is thinking that this is all about us. It's the human species. We are so centralized with our own importance that we have really neglected to see ourselves relative to habitat. And it's not just about us. It's about our relationship to the land we live on, to the watershed we live in, to the bioregion that we live in. And the bioregion is far more important to me than us, than we are. And the bioregions will probably come to prevail in totally different forms than we can live within at the rate we're going. The planet will continue to proceed through time, and there will be life forms. But unless we straighten up our act and really start working in consonance with homeland, we may not be around to enjoy this paradise in its future form. We've got to get past us and start thinking about the land itself. I'm really sorry, we're running low on time. What happens is when a bunch of us get together is it can go on all night, and what I really would dig is if we could all get into it and John can sleep with whoever he wants to. Anyway, I'm going to cut us off now. We've got to stop because I'm getting signals, but thank you so much for coming. Ha, ha, ha.